Wasn't it a little strange when we got that cold snap a few weeks ago, and then to hear that it was, well, some people at least were calling it the polar vortex. That was a surprise, too. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're going to spend the 90 minutes talking about climate and weather with our two weather guys. Normally, they're on for 45 minutes or so, but today, you guys are here the full load.
Mm, oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're just going to talk slowly.
Yeah.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests today. Of course, with the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, there are professors there. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. That really wasn't polar vortex. Well, first, what's the polar vortex?
John loves talking about the polar vortex because
yeah.
it's about his research. And he
yeah,
knows
actually it is, yeah. The polar vortex is a statement of the fact that the high latitudes of the Earth, either hemisphere, are colder than the low latitudes of Earth. So what happens is it's colder at high latitudes, and a consequence is there's a circulation around the hemisphere that kind of isolates the high latitude flow in a vortex. And it's very pronounced in the wintertime when it's very much colder in the northern North Pole regions than it is now. But it doesn't disappear all through the year. And so occasionally there's excursions of some of this air that's been cooled at high latitude to southern latitudes like ours. In fact, our convective afternoon yesterday was a result of very cold air aloft in a small area right over us. And it gave us those kind of intermittent thunder showers. So this kind of thing happens all the time. It's just recently gotten a lot of press because of last year's cold winter and somebody decided that they were going to christen this whole thing polar vortex, but the word's been in our science for seven or eight decades.
For a long time.
It's fun to say.
Polar yeah, it is.
Vortex.
It is. It sounds great. Right? It's a lot of consonant sounds that you don't usually
right.
throw together. It's great.
Yeah.
It is funny, though, because I don't remember ever hearing that term up until this last year.
Yeah, it exploded in the popular media, but it's been a term of art in the science for quite a time.
Yeah.
So.
But it is not unusual to have an appearance of it during the summer?
It's never as extreme as the ones you get in the wintertime. So I think what happened this year is that one thing's for sure, the overall pattern of the flow in the northern hemisphere, for at least for our longitudes, has not changed in a substantial way as we move from winter into summer. Temperatures have moderated because naturally it's just hotter to get desperately cold. It's impossible, actually, to get desperately cold at this time of year. But we've been predominantly in a west or northwesterly flow much of the summer, and that's kind of exactly what we had over the wintertime. Therefore, if you get a little break off of really colder polar air, it's going to find its way down here under those conditions. And that is a little bit unusual for the summertime, but not unprecedented.
You can join in. If you have a weather question, maybe there's something that's been bothering you, or maybe there's an interesting weather phenomena that you have observed recently, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And if you have some cool weather photos, we'd certainly love to see them as well. And we did have Phil on Facebook with a question for you. Would being located in a large expanse of plants, like number of square miles of cornfields, add to the possibility of local showers due to the increased water vapor added to the environment by the transpiring plants?
Yeah, so if you have a lot of plants transpiring moisture, then you'll increase the cloudiness of that area over other areas. Mm. In fact, they have this thing in Australia called the rabbit fence effect, where they put up a fence to keep the rabbits out, because they brought rabbits in and then they went crazy because they were an invasive species, essentially. And so if you look at a satellite image or a photograph of that area, you could see, you know, along the border of where the rabbit fence is, you can see where it's really green where the rabbits aren't and where it's not green where the rabbits are.
Yeah.
And then there's a statistical relationship in the cloud cover for the vegetated regions versus the clear regions. So you have more moisture in there to generate it, but you would still need to kick off the convection to get it going.
Yeah, to actually have it precipitate to form clouds, maybe not, because sometimes when they start planting cotton in the spring, it's kind of late February, early March, maybe, if I'm not wrong, down in Louisiana in the Delta. You can actually see that show up on satellite pictures in the next couple of weeks, because when it greens, and the leaves come out, they transpire also, and there's a little bit more water vapor in those locations, and you can see it manifest in clouds.
But now, what does it take, like, let's say Iowa, because we always associate corn in Iowa. I mean, what would it take to get more rain or moisture?
Not much. There's been a number of severe events in the southern part of Wisconsin, northern part of Illinois, parts of eastern Iowa that have definitely been a function of what they call it is dew point pooling, where the dew points are much higher in close proximity to these big fields, of agricultural fields, than they are anywhere else. Waterloo, Iowa, has dew points routinely in the 80s in July. Now, they may have something wrong with their measuring device. It's possible, but it seems to me that over 20 years that I've been here, that Waterloo stands out as the place with over 80 dew points most frequently is probably more likely a function of the fact that it's close to all of this agriculture. And so, as Steve points out, you have to have something to trigger organization of all of that water vapor and turn it into clouds. But in the summertime, that's not hard to come by. That happens relatively easily. That's why we get, you know, shower threats every day during the summertime or every other day. Mm-hmm. It's not that uncommon.
So what does it take then? It doesn't take much, but what is it that it needs to have?
So you need to get the air lifting, and so that's usually done by the sun just heating the ground up.
Okay.
And that's why, again, even if you don't generate precipitation, you'll see these scattered cumulus clouds all over because that hot air rises, and the more humidity allows it to hit a dew point or the relative humidity of 100% quicker, and then boom, a cloud forms.
Yeah.
There we go. We've got Anna Lisa in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Anna Lisa.
Hi. Yeah, I don't know if this relates to what you were just talking about, but we've had a number of days, we've had no rain, you know, in July. All we've had is a half an inch up here. And the clouds will pile up, and it'll look just like it's going to rain any minute, and then it just blows over. They just dissipate. What happens to that?
Mm. Good question. There's so many things that have to happen right before a cloud will actually drop precipitation out of the bottom of it, and then that precipitation will hit you on the head. Clouds are made up of tiny water droplets and in some cases ice particles. Even here in the summertime, the tops of the clouds are made of ice. But those things have to grow, and it takes a period of time for them to grow to a certain size that will allow them to actually fall through the cloud and not be relatively suspended and almost in the same position. And then when they start to fall, they fall through air that's not saturated, and so they can begin to evaporate. And if there's enough dry air between the base of the cloud and the ground, even if those particles that fall out of the cloud are big enough to start falling through the air, they may evaporate and never reach the ground. And that's, I think, what's been happening around here an awful lot of the time. We've seen some pretty decent-looking mid-level cumulus clouds, dark enough for me to suspect that things are falling out of them. In fact, Saturday night, you could even see the snow falling out of the higher alto cirrus clouds. But that's probably one of the things that could be going on. It's been an interesting cloud summer. A lot of times we've come up dry.
Yeah. And actually, this afternoon, yesterday, we were walking around at a festival, and one of these dark clouds came over, and it didn't dump, heavy precipitation. It was just scattered little drops, and a lot of them were just evaporating on the way down, so they don't quite get to us.
So there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. We open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Maybe you've witnessed an interesting weather phenomena lately or have some other questions about the weather. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. NPR has been doing a recent series about probability, and you know, it got Judith wondering, actually. She said, what does it mean when there is a 20 or a 40 or 80% chance of precipitation? You know?
Yeah, a lot of people misinterpret that.
Yes,
they do. So we're glad to say. I don't think if NPR actually has published the answer yet, but I know they had a short multiple choice quiz you could take. So you can go in and get the right answer, which is when they say that you have a 20% chance of precipitation, where you live, what it means, if we had 100 days that were exactly like the current day that we have, on 20 of those days, it would actually rain in your spot.
Yeah.
And Yeah.
So it's kind of like what John was just talking about with regard to the precipitation. You can have all the right conditions, but you're just missing one thing that keeps the rain from actually getting to the ground.
Yeah, and that one thing might be a little bit hard to detect in the forecast office and therefore specify where it might not happen. And what you just said, Steve, is exactly right. It's a perfect answer. But it has a couple of manifestations. Last night was a good example where we had these scattered showers. Mm-hmm. It was obvious that there were going to be scattered thunder showers. What's not obvious is your backyard going to be underneath one of them over the course of their, 4 hour or so life cycle in the afternoon? And you can't really say that with certainty. So it's best to say, if I have 20 such days, is no way, or 100 such days, there's no way that on 20 of them your backyard isn't going to see some of that rain. And so that it translates to roughly the same statement.
Yeah. And we've had a lot of scattered showers around Madison these last couple of days.
Yeah, true.
And unfortunately, they're missing my yard.
Yeah.
Because I need water on my flowers.
We all need water on the flowers.
Yeah, it's been
Somebody
dry.
Somebody was
yeah.
telling me that last night there was at a concert in Madison at the called it Atwood Fest.
The Atwood, yeah. That was the one we were at. Right?
Yeah, and they were watching, they were standing on the street and watching the stage, and it was raining on the stage, but they had no,
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You see that, we lived in Colorado for like 10 or 11 years, and you see that a lot in Colorado because it's so open. So you could be on this long road, and you can see down the road, it's raining right there.
Yeah.
And we went to 3 festivals yesterday, so this is married to a folklorist. So we were at another festival where it just poured, and it was right during a softball tournament game.
Oh,
and it just poured, right, yeah, of course. And down by our house, this was up in Wanakee, and down by our house, which isn't far from Wanakee, again, I got like 3/100ths of an inch.
Yeah,
nothing.
Nothing, yeah. So it's really spotty.
Yeah, we had a good shower at my house. I'm married to a tennis player, and so I'm nervous. She's always asking me for the forecast, and I tell her, there's about a 30% chance it's going to rain on your tennis. What does that mean? And it didn't rain that much where she was playing, but it poured at my house, so I was nervous.
Did she come home and yell at you?
No, and I knew something hadn't happened far away.
Oh, we have Diane in Milwaukee up next. Diane, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I want to know, it's not September yet. It's not even August yet. Why are the leaves from my trees falling down?
Yeah, I got some falling, too. I think it's a water stress.
Is it a water stress?
Yeah, it's a water stress, and it's not only this year. It's a stress from like 2 years ago.
2012 was desperate.
We had really, really dry conditions, mm-hmm. and people don't water their trees, typically. I mean, a lot of
but
people.
But it rained.
Well, it rained a little, but it didn't
rain
enough.
It rained a lot in Milwaukee.
Well, it still has to get deep into the soil.
Really deep.
I'm guessing that, if not that, there are certain diseases of trees. There's something called maple decline, for example, that affects maple trees, and that manifests itself typically with leaf drop, early leaf drop. So that's another part of it.
Maples.
Yeah. What are they?
Maples,
yeah. Well, it could be it could be you're seeing some maple decline, but part of the reason for maple decline typically is that they've been under stress. And they're all trees, I can pretty well say most 99% of the trees here in the southern Wisconsin at least are under a lot of stress. So but look up maple decline in your go to Google and look up maple decline and you'll probably get a little bit more on that, Diane. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Kurt in Algoma next. Kurt, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question revolves around the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. What kind of general effect does it have on our weather here? I know typically along the lake shore we're 10 to 15 degrees cooler than, say, Green Bay, which is only, 40, 45 miles away. Just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, Great Lakes have a big impact on the weather and the climate and the region around it, particularly when they're down or upwind of where you live. In the summertime, and I think this is what you're seeing in Algoma for sure, the cooler waters of the lake, and they're really cold this year, abnormally cold because it's such a cold winter, really cools the air around it. Mm-hmm. And even smaller lakes. I know there's some people who will argue this, but, you know, we live on a shoreline of a smaller lake. And I'll tell you, in the summertime, we are a lot cooler and more pleasant at our house than when we go into the,
on Saturday.
City.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting you point this out, Steve, about last year's cold winter. Because one of the effects that the Great Lakes have as an aggregate, a group of five lakes, is that they tend to have the lower the pressure over the state of Michigan during the wintertime, because then that state is surrounded by warmer waters, at least for November and December, part of January. I wonder if that's going to, and that can promote a little bit more snowfall in the state of Michigan. Not really something that's noticeable except to a person keeping really close eye on it. But I wonder if that'll not be the case this year, because the lakes are struggling to warm up. So they're going to go into the fall and winter cooler this year than they were last year. I don't know how that won't be true.
Yeah,
and so it's got it's bound to have a lessened impact.
Yeah, you know, we took 30 years of satellite data and, you know, detected clouds and where they were, and then averaged it or composited it as a function of wind direction.
Mm.
And we did this over the Great Lakes region. And whenever the wind was coming at a certain direction on a Great Lake, downwind, it was almost 100% cloudy.
Is that right?
Yeah. Wow. So that the main fact, I think, is the evaporation. As long as the water is not frozen, the evaporation can feed
so
the clouds, and then also the precipitation.
But then how about precipitation? Do you know about that? I mean,
we
lake
can't
effect,
get precipitation
okay,
from the satellites.
Because lake effect does depend on the air ocean, the air lake temperature difference.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Maybe that's not as sensitive for actually evaporation created producing clouds, but making precipitation sized particles, maybe it's a little more important.
I would think it would be a lot more important, right? Because you want to have more time to build those precipitation particles.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, thank
you. All right, well, thank you very much.
Appreciate your call. Talking weather today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with my two guests today from the UW, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys. Questions for them? Go on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question there if you got a great weather photo. We'd certainly love to see that. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Julius in Augusta has a question for you guys. Julius, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'd like to know if all the rainforest down in South America that is cut off, if that has any effect on our weather. And Saturday night when that storm come over, the lightning was so intense that it was just like daylight down here, it would be flashing that much. Why?
So, you know, I know that they have run climate models simulating if you took out the rainforest in South America, what would happen? And I know there was impact on the weather in North America, though I don't remember what the answer was. But
there
the rainforest, there would be some impact. I don't remember which direction it would go. It changes, of course, the precipitation down in South America over the rainforest is kind of what we were alluding to earlier, in that getting precipitation is a function of the ground that's below, and the rainforests transpire a lot, so it puts a lot of moisture in the air. And once you cut them down, the soil in that area isn't that deep, and so you end up with grasses that won't produce as much transpiration.
Yeah, yeah. If I had to make a guess, I'd guess that it would be less stormy in the southeast United States, because I think it would have an impact on the subtropical jet stream and weaken it. But I don't know if that's right.
Yeah, and it's not an experiment we really want to do.
No, we don't.
Theoretical models.
Well, what about this lightning business?
I didn't even know about the lightning Saturday night. I guess I missed it.
I missed it too, and I was waiting. As I mentioned earlier, we were watching a softball game. We didn't know anybody playing, but it was a close game, so it was fun to watch. And when that rain came and the umps eventually called a timeout and got everybody off the field, I was worried about it, you know, lightning showing up, because then they would have canceled it, because it was in the top of the seventh and it was a close game. It was tie, actually.
Can't have it. I wonder if one thing that comes to mind, though, might be that if you have a preponderance of cloud-to-ground lightning in a given thunderstorm, then maybe the lightning's going to be brighter because it's not obscured by being inside the clouds. I don't know if that's the case or not.
Oh, that could be, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe it just happened to be. And then you'd still have to answer that question. How come there's so much cloud-to-ground lightning if that turned out to be the reason?
Yeah.
And I don't have an answer for that, but that would be my first guess.
Oh.
Well, it started about 9:30, and it worked from the – it went towards Falkirk, and then it come right around back over – where we live out here on the farm. I was going to unload another load of hay, but I decided against that when it started to rain.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
Did
yeah,
you happen to... I'm sorry. Did you happen to see a lot of the strikes, you know, coming out of the clouds on that day? Was that different than normal or no?
Oh, yeah, it was just... all the time, it was just flashing constantly.
Yeah, interesting.
One right after another, and... Thunderheads, they just built right up there, great big. You could see the thunderheads and everything else.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Wow.
I've never seen one like it before. I've been around 75 years.
Yeah, it was a pretty potent little atmospheric disturbance that came through the state on Saturday night, and with very cold air in mid-levels, and that's unusual. That's why we're kind of cooler the last couple of days, but... And that can be kind of on the ingredients list for particularly good-looking thunderstorms. Maybe that's what was going on there.
Could be, yeah.
Hey, I got another question. Does it have to be 40 below zero above the clouds to produce snow and rain?
No.
No.
That minus 40 is a temperature at which you don't get liquid water, that it freezes. But
that's what the guy.
That's what the number's
about.
For, yeah. Mm.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Julius. Thank you for calling. John in Madison wondered, would you remind us, what is the amount of weight of water in a cubic mile above during a moderate rainfall? Wow.
A lot.
Good question. Maybe. Cubic miles, a huge volume. I don't know it off the top of my head. I know that in a reasonable thunderstorm environment, you probably have 15 grams per kilogram of water vapor. So every kilogram of air, which occupies what? I don't know how much volume. That's the thing I don't know, but it's a lot of water, and it's a staggering amount of water. I wish I could do that calculation quickly, but I'm missing a couple of pieces of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a gallon of water costs weighs 8 pounds, right, roughly?
Yeah, yeah. Right, right.
So you can just imagine after a rainfall how many gallons that was.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a lot.
It's a stunning amount, yeah. And a cubic mile is a gigantic volume.
Volume, yeah.
That's a big volume.
Well... We may still yet be able to come up with it before the end of the show.
Yeah,
maybe at our news break we'll get out the calculators and see what we can come up
with. Well, I got this off the top of my head because I did this in my class. If you take 5 inches of snow over Dane County, you can figure out how much area there is in Dane County. 5 inches of snow is about a half inch of liquid equivalent. The amount of energy released in converting that water from the vapor to the liquid to the ice phase is enough to power the Madison metro area for 400 years. One 5-inch snowstorm.
Yeah. Wow.
So we're talking about huge numbers of not only water, but energy. It's staggering.
Staggering. Yeah. Well, Ben, in Mayville, do you have something staggering for us? Or not?
How you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good. I got a question about lenticular clouds. I'm from out west, and they're one of my most favorite clouds. They're pretty amazing to watch. And I know they form over mountains. Is there any possibility that it would form over like cumulus clouds? Before, I've seen some on higher end of cumulus clouds. And I know Reno, Nevada has some of the most amazing lenticulars I've ever seen on a regular basis.
Hmm.
Yeah, you can see them, and I don't know if they're called lenticular, though. They're called
Pileus.
Something else. Pileus.
Pileus
right,
clouds,
yeah. Right, I call it Pileus.
Yeah.
I don't know what's right.
I had a British advisor, so he says Pileus.
Pileus,
they
look just like a lenticular cloud in that they're lens-shaped, and they occur on the top of active thunderstorms. But it's a very different formation in that... In these lenticular clouds that you see with mountains, it's airflow over the mountains. And then the air goes up and down. It has to do with the temperature structure and the stability of the atmosphere. And the air goes up and down like a roller coaster. And where it's on the up part is where you can generate where those lenticular clouds are. I think these Pileus, Pileus, what do you, how do you say?
Pileus.
Pileus.
I don't know if that's right.
Right. We should look that up. Another thing to do during a news break. Are generated in part by the vertical propagation of energy that goes associated with the thunderstorm.
Yeah, I thought it was that the air hits the updraft, and the updraft itself is an obstacle to the horizontal flow of the air. So
like
it goes
a,
up over the hump of the updraft. Yeah, it's a, it might as well be a piece of stone or something. Yeah. You can't get through it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, on a side note, some of the worst flying I ever did was commuting between L.A. and Reno more often than once. The pilot wouldn't even let the stewardesses out of their seats. It gets pretty turbulent, that area.
Yeah, and you get rotor clouds and these big rotors right in the lee of the mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're bad news.
And those are real turbulent.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate you. Rotor cloud, what is it?
Rotor cloud.
So rotor cloud.
You get a giant horizontally oriented vortex that's kind of in the lee of the mountains, and they'll play with your plane like it's an annoying fly.
Right.
They're really bad
And you
stuff.
Don't want to be on those waves.
No.
Well, you guys should take a look at our Facebook page here, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We have from Jill the coolest photo.
That's pretty awesome.
She's got lightning all over the place in the sky, and then right there as well, a rainbow.
Boy, yeah. And did she say if she took that photo?
Yeah, she said, this is my best shot.
Yeah, I can see
from
why you
the amazing storm.
Yeah.
Is the foreground
stormy
a lake?
Red sunset we had, I think, on July 1st, she thought it was.
Was, huh? Yeah, I mean, this is interesting because you could see the lightning bolts and some of them are going from the cloud to the ground, which we often talk about.
Yeah.
But you see ones going horizontally, and those are ones that are more than likely going between the clouds in that same cloud. So this is the difference. Tonight's photo will show that difference as well.
Yeah.
And then there's a rainbow often. And you can get this. I don't think I've ever actually seen it. But you get rainbows when, you know, the rain is in the distance and the sun is to your back. And it's not raining by you. And
yeah.
So you can see this, though. I've never seen it.
Neither have I, yeah. So you're looking at a storm that already went over you.
Went over you,
yeah,
right.
It's still active. That's pretty cool.
On the horizon.
And there's another one in there, but of course I can't. I'll get it adjusted. And we'll in the meantime, go to John in North Madison. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm interested in hearing what the fellows have to say about the high humidity this year, this summer, compared to the rain that's not been falling, and also whether any national or international agency actually tracks humidity on a chronological basis over decades. I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, certainly NOAA and the National Weather Service will keep records of the dew point. You often don't see it in terms of statistics,
right,
for sure. But
it gets kind of mixed in with the temperature in a variable that we call the equivalent potential temperature. So that can be a way to measure how much the water vapor content of the air is adding to the discomfort of the air in a very systematic way. But yeah, you're right. You don't usually hear too many stories about that.
Yeah.
But I would think that. My impression of this summer, and maybe it depends on where exactly you are in the state or in the region, but my impression of this summer has been it's very mild in terms of humidity. We've had only a couple of episodes of high humidity. Last Tuesday or the week before on Tuesday was one example, but they've been few and far between in my sense of it.
Yeah, and I don't like humid air very much
personally,
but yeah, I think it's actually been a pretty pleasant summer.
Yeah.
Although, again, this weekend it got a little humid,
yeah.
At least to some people. But I had family out from North Carolina, and they just kind of looked
at
me.
Must
like,
have laughed
what are you
at it.
Yeah. Humid?
Oh, I want to show you Jill's other photo that was up on Facebook.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So she said, this is my second best from that storm. And the sky is
it's pretty awesome.
Yellows and reds.
And we had that around here a couple of weeks ago where the sky really turned yellow. And some of that may be associated with the forest fires that are, you know, burning in the area because they tend to take the blues out. And, you know, thinking back to the other photo that you with the lightning and the rainbow, the reds in that rainbow were really intense in comparison
true.
To everything else, which
that's
is...
Right.
And again, it may be the fact that it's at sunset and most of it is the red, and so that's what you're going to really see.
It's really very... Jill, you got some great shots there. Thank you. And we have Tom in Colesburg, Iowa, with a comment. Hi. Thank you for calling, Tom.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, you were talking about percentages of chances of rain, and it seems to make more sense to me that if they say 100% chance of rain and it doesn't rain, then it's probably 100% chance that somebody in your area is going to get rain. Does that make more sense?
It, to me, if they say 100% rain and it doesn't rain, then, man, they made a 100% mistake.
Yeah.
Because right. You should never say 100% chance of anything unless you're really, really sure.
And the Weather Service will do that, and then yeah. They are sure. It's rare that that kind of forecast makes a mistake, but I think...
Well, we've had it happen a number of times. We've
yeah.
had it happen with snow, and we've had it happen with rain, and it's both before our area. We've got a weather radio that... we're in Clayton County, and that is one of the counties they're reporting on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I've seen it for winter storms in particular, when you got
that's
a front
the
coming.
The only time I can think of it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think I've ever seen it in the summertime. For it's
really, we had it happen just here a week or two ago.
Yeah. Really?
Huh. Yeah, that's kind of really going out on a limb. Then you've got some aggressive and confident forecasters in your area, because I would, as Steve says, I'd feel pretty confident I could say that in the wintertime when the storms are well organized and they have several days life cycle. But boy, a thunderstorm, even a widespread outbreak, I'd be nervous to say 100. I might say 90. That might be as high as I go.
I mean, we had a caller saying right how they were at a just downtown, and so they could see it's raining on one part of the street and not on the other.
Mm.
And so it is so stochastic. Yeah. That
right. Interesting.
There you go. Thanks, Tom.
Yep.
Appreciate the call. And we have Mark in Maple Grove, Minnesota next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually have a couple questions. We spend a lot of time in Fort Wayne in the summer, which is about halfway between Bayfield and Superior.
Mm-hmm.
And we always look at the weather report before we drive there, and it's not that accurate. They call it the sunny South Shore, and there seems to be this area roughly between Fort Wayne and Superior where it's warmer and sunnier, and we can sit there and watch storms march up the North Shore again and again and again, and we seldom get that weather. So that's my first question, why the sunny South Shore? And then my second question is, how do they do a weather report for a little town like Fort Wayne? Is that just an average extrapolated in a large area? How do they get that specific for those little towns for the weather report? So those are my two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you're so there's two ways I would say they do the normal small area, whether it's a small town or a city. If it's done computer-wise, then, yeah, it's going to be a grid forecast, and then they're going to interpolate down to a specific area. If you have someone physically talking about it, like somebody on the news channel, they'll do some of that interpolation as well, but then they'll do their own interpretation based on their knowledge of the geology of the area. And I imagine that's what you're seeing with the forecast in between Fort Wayne and Superior, is that, you know, that's a small area, and you're dealing with a really big gradient in the surface type in terms of the land and then the cold Lake Superior as well. And so the chances of getting it wrong probably go up.
Yeah, and I wonder about the sunny South Shore. I think in the summertime, I don't think people would refer to it sunny in the wintertime, but maybe I'm wrong. But in the summertime, the prevailing...
It's
a summertime thing. And the prevailing wind direction for our whole state in the summertime, I would say, is more likely southwesterly than northwesterly. This summer is an exception. And that's going to definitely mean that the upwind side of the lake is going to be warmer and sunnier than the downwind side, which has a chance for that air to evaporate water off that lake. Mm-hmm. And even with northwesterly flow, when you're coming across Duluth Superior, you've got the bluffs there in Duluth, which probably contribute something, not very large amount, but something to subsidence and a little bit of warming in their immediate lee. I don't know if that has anything to do with why there's a sense that, you know, Port Wayne is going to be a local warm spot on some days, but it might have something to do with it. So that's the local geography, as Steve points out, is really important.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Malcolm and Rhinelander up next. Hi, Malcolm. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It has to do with barometric pressure. It seems like when the weather is reported these days, you know, both on TV and in the newspapers, they don't talk much about barometric pressure anymore. Is that not that useful, or what's happened to it?
Hmm. You know, I'm wondering if in the summertime it's not as useful as in the wintertime, when you're dealing with the passage of fronts, and then you really do have pressure drops and pressure increases really as harbingers of what's coming. Whereas in the summertime, you have a lot of convection, and it's a matter of whether or not that thunderstorm is going to hit you or miss you.
Yeah, there's nothing less scientifically interesting or valuable about it than there used to be. I just wonder if there isn't commercial pressure on some of these broadcast outlets that give you the information. They're probably trying to figure out how can we do this as quickly as possible so we can get to the next thing. And maybe that's just one variable that doesn't have a clear impact on a person's sense of how they feel comfortable or uncomfortable with the weather. The pressure doesn't usually affect many people. Temperature and the dew point do. I wonder if that isn't it. But it's certainly an important variable.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it just seemed like you didn't see much about that anymore, so I thought I'd ask.
Yeah, I wonder what it is. It's interesting.
I often wondered. I have family living for quite a while in Yuma, Arizona, and I'd watch the weather forecast and go, why did they even bother to have a weather forecast in Yuma, Arizona, because it's always the same every single day. It's about 100 degrees in the summer, and it's not going to rain.
Yeah. Right, yeah, 10% chance, probably, right?
Oh, boy. We are talking weather today. Weather and climate. We've gotten into some climate issues, too, with Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Join in. If you have a weather or climate question, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly if you have a great weather photo, we would love to see it as well. We've got some questions that came up on email. Bill in Madison wonders, what builds the charge in a thunderstorm cloud? Is there a charge build up in the ground? And why does lightning hit the ground?
So, yeah, there is a charge that gets built up in the cloud first. And that is basically liquid drops colliding with the ice crystals back and forth, and when they interact and rub, and it generates a charge within the cloud. And then once you generate that charge in the cloud, that then generates a cloud, a charge on the ground.
Okay.
Because like charges repel, and so if you get negative charges on the ground, that's going to attract the positive charges. I mean, the negative charges at the base of the cloud, then that'll generate positive charges on the ground. And the lightning bolt is a way to try and ameliorate that, get rid of it, balance it back out.
We have Brian in Thorpe with a question. Hi, Brian.
Hello. How's it going today?
Great. Thanks for calling. What have you got for us today?
Well, here's something I've never seen before, but now Saturday, we live by Thorpe, and it was, I know you talked about the humidity before, but it seemed like it was terrible by Thorpe, or where we were Saturday. And off in the east sky, we've seen, like, stripes in the sky. It looked like rainbows. Like, it started with one, but there were no color to them. They were just kind of like a haze or like the sun. And, they did the curvature of the earth like a rainbow. And then the more we watched, there got to be two, and then a third one. You know, like you sometimes will see a double rainbow. But there again, with no rain and no rainbow, but the silhouette was there.
Hmm. Well, there. What time of day was this again?
This was probably about 2:30 a.m.
So late in the afternoon. So the sun was more in the west.
Yep, yep. Hmm. I mean, so we were looking off into the southeast sky, more east than south. And it's almost like you were looking at a rainbow, but there was no color to it at all.
Were there clouds down there?
It was a light haze. Not really cloudy, but like a light haze. You could see the sky through it.
Huh. Yeah, I know. You stumped me. I mean, it sounds like sort of like a what you would get in a fog bow, which is like a rainbow, but it occurs in a fog. But I don't think you get those in a hazy atmosphere. The particles are probably too small. To make it visible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so I don't know.
My wife, I do believe, got some pictures. So maybe I'll have to put them on Facebook.
Post them up on my Facebook.
Post them on Larry's Facebook, and then we'll take a look at it, see if we can figure it out.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. I hope he does. I'd like to see.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that. Dave in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. A
couple of questions. What's the likelihood of an El Nino coming this year?
One is building, and they think it's going to be a moderate one, which probably won't affect us too bad in terms of our winter weather.
Yeah, they seem to have ratcheted down the enthusiasm for it, haven't they?
They did. A couple of months ago, they were really enthusiastic about being strong.
Yeah. And so something, it's not my specialty. I don't think it's Steve's either, but there's a whole array of buoys out in the tropical Pacific Ocean. So this is now observationally based as well as model based. And so something must have come in the observations in June and maybe late May that kind of said, hey, our initial predictions of a strong event don't seem to be taking shape. So... yeah, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah,
it's a nice combination now of forecasting these events and then tracking the progress of them in the observations. We didn't have that recently, till now.
Okay. The other question is, I can't find a number for the cumulative effect of all the greenhouse gas increases in the past 130, 140 years, or whatever it is. I know, like, carbon dioxide's up 40-some percent, and water vapor, I've heard, is up about 7%. But has somebody done a weighted average of all those?
Well, they have different residence times. It's not particularly fair to include water vapor in with carbon dioxide and methane, because water vapor is rained out of the atmosphere every 9 days. So imagine if it weren't, you taking fossil water and irrigating fields would be a big problem. You'd be changing the radiation balance of the planet in a big way. But it doesn't happen because you just get rid of it so quick. But carbon dioxide and methane last for a long time. Carbon dioxide, about 100-year residence time. So, you know, when you put some in, it takes a long time for it to find its way out.
Yeah. I just wondered if somebody had worked out the percent increase of those, of everything over the past, century plus.
I'm sure that in terms of net radiative impact, an integrated quantity has been done. I think that's on, what is that, in the order of 5 watts per meter squared or something like that?
It's a little less, four.
So that's...
But again, it seems like a small number, but it's a big number.
Right. The fact is, it won't go away, but it is, by percentage-wise, it is a small number.
Right. It's just that you keep...
increase of 5 percentage points?
No, much less than that, even. Is it 4 divided by about 1,300 right average? So it's 0.4 or something.
Yeah.
Okay. And
I'm trying to think, the global concentration of carbon dioxide has gone from about 330 to almost up to 400.
Right.
So an increase of 70 out of
330. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the 30-ish or 40% range, right?
Yeah.
I heard that, in the 1880s or so, they were getting measurements about 280 parts per million.
Somewhere around 300 has been about right for the last, maybe two centuries ago or a century ago. Yeah. But now it's 400. Last summer was the first month we had
it. We've had
400 for an average. Unbelievable. Mm.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And more callers. Bob in Madison, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking a call. I have a question concerning the Olympics back, I don't even know what year it was, but in Japan they claimed they were seeding clouds to make it snow. Do you remember this, and did it work?
1972, Sapporo Olympics. But
I think it might have been post-Sapporo.
So there was one just a few years
Nagano
ago.
Oh, Nagano they had him. Nagano, yeah, they had him in Nagano.
Yeah.
Yes, and I remember... the reporter is saying that they're going to make it snow for us, and the government was working on it. And I was wondering, did that ever work, and where did that go?
I don't think there has been any study that statistically proves that seeding clouds will increase precipitation. So yeah. They may have done it in the hopes that it'll do it, but...
What would their process be, simply?
Simply, they put in... So to get an ice crystal to form, you need something that has a similar molecular structure. And silver iodide is one of those materials that'll do that. It'll look like an ice crystal, and so water will condense on it, and you'll have more ice. And that's easier to grow big particles to fall out of the sky. And so they'll seed it by just dispersing silver iodide particles into the atmosphere in very low concentrations. Mm. So it's not like it would be visible to see them. But
And the problem with the... go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, was that a safe process, or I don't know.
Is it a safe process? I think in general it is.
Yeah,
they do it in
too.
The mountain regions back in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s.
Yeah, in Colorado.
In Colorado
places.
And Utah.
The problem is you can't, it's an experiment without the proper scientific method. You can't say anything about what would have happened if you hadn't intervened. And so how can you assess your success? It's impossible.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well, it's quite interesting. I remember it, and it still bugs me to this day. So thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry and Wanakee? No, I'm sorry. Jerry and Menasha, you are next. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Last winter was the most severe I experienced in Wisconsin for the 37 years I've lived here. Not only did we have brutally low temperatures and a tremendous amount of precipitation, gobs of snow, I couldn't believe it, but the thing that was the worst was the terribly high winds that blew consistently throughout the winter. Here in Wisconsin, the wind seems to blow at least 360 days a year. That's why I can't understand the resistance to wind turbine farms. But nevertheless, that's another issue. But it was dreadful, and I'm hoping that you can tell me that we are going to have, and I suspect from what you've said already, a milder winter coming up.
Jerry, I'll go on the record telling you we will have a milder winter in the coming year.
Milder in comparison to last year?
It's an easy forecast because you almost never see back-to-back extremes. But and top that off with the fact that even a moderate El Nino will certainly have an impact towards making this winter a little more mild than last winter, most likely. So I think that's probably a safe bet. But last winter was grand, wasn't it?
Thank you for calling. And Bill in Elm Grove, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Listen, we have a home in Florida we go to.
I assume you do that in the winter.
My neighbors say, we're not down there in the summer, but my neighbors say it's the thunderstorm and lightning capital of the world, Central Florida.
Oh, yeah.
That's
so
correct.
We have lightning rods on our house, and I wonder if you'd give an opinion on how effective you think the lightning rods are.
Oh, that's a good question. And the debate here, I think, is associated with putting a lightning rod on houses that are in subdivisions. So I'm not going to talking about a lone barn sitting on a hillside in the farm fields of Wisconsin.
Right.
And the risk there, I think people argue, is... If your house, are you increasing the likelihood that your house will get hit because you have this metal rod sticking up that your neighbors don't have? And so as a lightning bolt is trying to find its way down, it's going to be looking for a good conductor to connect to on the ground. Of course, if it does get hit, then you have a good chance of being, helping your household out in terms of not shorting out all the electric currents in there, because if it does hit the lightning rod, then it'll, go down to the ground and not go through your house.
Yeah, well, what about a barn out someplace? Are they effective out isolated buildings someplace?
When you have an isolated building sitting on a house, then, I think it's prudent to have it up because you're the tallest object on the landscape, and a lot of time there's metals and barns and things like that, so there's a good this increases your chances of getting hit.
Mm.
So you might as well put up lightning rods. And if you look at most of the barns in Wisconsin anyway, you'll see a series of lightning rods that run across the top of the roofs. And I think the idea there is, if you get hit,
I think if you have the lightning rod, and it's better to have it on your house if you're going to get hit, I guess, right? Because it'll ground the land.
Yeah, yeah. The debate that I've seen is what is it when you have a village?
Yeah, because everybody's got an equal chance of being struck. But if you have a lone bon out there on a hill, you don't have equal chances. You're going to get hit, right. So you might as well direct the current somewhere else. Yeah.
But now, do you have it? Doesn't it have to be grounded properly and all that, or you just stick?
Oh yeah. So I'm assuming that it's grounded properly.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah. If you don't have it grounded properly, then you're definitely in trouble.
You got problems.
Yeah, it was installed by professionals. So.
Yeah.
And some of our neighbors have lightning rods also. So,
So that might be, a culture in Florida, because as you point out, that is the hottest place for lightning in the U.S.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not in the world.
In the U.S. Anyway.
In the U.S. In Africa, along the intertropical convergence zone, that's where most lightning actually is.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Marion DeLuce said a small group of mammamus clouds went by, and we used to call those as kids tornado eggs.
Ah, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's the idea is there's an association between mammatus clouds and severe weather environments. And that's, it's often true. It's not always true. And so it's not a one-to-one correspondence. But a lot of times when you've had a really good thunderstorm go by, you might see a mammatus deck at some point in the afternoon there. So that's interesting that they call them that.
Oh. Well, there you go. Our guests today are our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today, and you'll be able to join in with your questions and comments. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Always lots of great information to share when we have our weather guys on and talk weather and climate with our two men here from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. They are both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And guys, thanks for coming by again.
Oh, yeah, it's a pleasure.
It's a great time to come by.
Oh, it's always fun to have you here. And if you have a question for them, a weather and climate question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We're getting some great photos as well, weather photos. And certainly if you have a good one, put it up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Jeff in Kenosha has been waiting a while, so let's go there. Jeff, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's great to talk to you guys. I usually listen from the archive, but I got the opportunity today.
Great.
Paul, I can't remember which one of you said that you were studying the snow cover in Western Canada to see how it affects our winters. And
oh,
the
yeah,
time,
yeah.
There wasn't any. I was wondering how that went, because it sure had a cold one.
Yeah, we had a visitor from, can't remember now where he came from Vermont, Alan Betts. In the first week of November, and I was talking to him about this idea that, when does the snow fall in Western Canada and what does that do to the temperature of November, December, and kind of lead us into the wintertime. And he in his presentation, he had information about how the snow falls in the second week of November in many of the prairie provinces of Canada for the first time, and that's when the temperature starts to go down most rapidly in the fall and early part of the winter in Canada and northern United States. And son of a gun, I've got a student now working on the snow cover connection to our temperature trends, hemispherically anyway, or regionally over North America. And we don't have an answer yet, but I think that we're onto something pretty interesting here. It's maybe not surprising, but to nail it down will be very satisfying to be able to say, if you have an anomalous snow cover in Western Canada, at a certain time of year, let's say mid to late October, you should expect November and December to be a little bit cooler than normal in several locations. Maybe not the West Coast, maybe not the East Coast, but maybe the Central United States. So we're on to that problem. We still haven't solved it, but we're on it.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff.
So you think you'd be able to use that to do like a monthly forecast of what the temperature trend would be?
I'd be afraid to make a monthly forecast. I would put it in these terms. I'd probably say, here is, we've got unusual early snowfall in Western Canada. Be on alert for You know, the tendency for the flow to start to be modified by the presence of that snow. And so, you know, if you start then to see a preponderance of, you'd also want to know how often is the flow from the northwest in late October and in November. If it starts to look more northwesterly than normal, then you maybe say, hey, the snow is having that impact. Watch out for the right. for the early part of the winter. So it would be a progressive sense that you were getting that these signals that are coming in early are showing you a way that maybe is going to take shape. Huh.
Cool. Dick in Waukesha has something for us. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I have a strange thing that happened. Interesting. My wife and I were driving from St. Paul to get back home to Waukesha, a long ways to go, and it poured rain all the way to I-94, and then it didn't rain very hard, it seemed, but the brightest rainbow I think I ever saw, and big wide bands, and everybody on the road slowed down. The cars, all the trucks, 10, 15 miles an hour slower than we had been going. What causes the width of the bars of color in the rainbow? And there was a faint second one off to the left, very, very faint.
I think the width of the rainbow itself and maybe the colors within it are probably going to be related to the size of the raindrops that are generating it.
Yeah.
That's about the only thing I can think of.
And then the contrast between where you see the rainbow and how bright the sky is behind you can make it look brighter or less bright, depending on how that's tuned also. So there's a lot of circumstances to go into it. But I think the raindrop thing is probably the key.
Yeah,
we had hardly any rain, but where the rainbow was must have had a lot.
I was in Janesville early July, where it didn't rain much over us, but you could tell it was raining heavily to our south, and there was a tremendous rainbow. Caught everybody's attention.
Yeah.
Yeah, same way.
And I saw one like that, too, in Madison. Actually, it was several years back now, but it was along John Nolan Drive. Actually, cars pulled over.
People
pulled over to look because it was across Lake Monona.
Yeah.
So you had this beautiful view of it, and it was just the most, well, just like Dick's saying, you know, it was just the most vivid colors that you can imagine.
I bet everybody's got that memory of this rainbow that is really vivid.
Right, yeah. Right. And hopefully not too many people are saying, I wish I'd stopped to look at it, because I'm glad to hear this story here from Dick that so many people actually were tuned in on this. This
is a
great thing, because they don't come that often, you know, when they really strike you.
Absolutely. Dick, thank you.
Interestingly, the fellow that answered the phone to me had the same experience down near Hudson.
Sure.
Probably a different rainbow.
It's like Steve says. It's probably everybody's got that one memory.
Yeah.
Thank you. Jackie in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. My question is about lightning. My family and I lived in this house for 60 years. We've had dogs, but it is pertinent. About 2.5 months ago, there was a storm. The lightning did not come down. Another neighbor saw it, too. Didn't come down from the clouds. It was snaking all over the ground. I wouldn't let my dog out. Now, were both of us, the neighbor and I, seeing things?
Whoa.
When does that happen?
I wonder if it's one of those
St. Elmo's fire type thing.
It could have been.
So was it running along the ground?
It was running along the ground and over a couple of different neighbors. I mean, it wasn't just me.
Did it have a color to it?
It looked white.
Looked white. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's this thing called St. Elmo's fire. And it's not fire. It's electric charge, much like, you know, when you get a shock or something, you'll see that little electric spark, and it'll just travel over objects. But usually it'll follow along metal. So if you're seeing it, you know, travel along the ground and moving over bushes, then maybe it was something else.
Yeah. Did you have chain link fences around in your neighborhood?
That could be. Yeah.
I have a chain link fence. Nobody else does.
Maybe that's part of the story.
It was in an area across the street where they don't. It wasn't just in my yard.
Wow.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Elmo's fire.
Look that up, and you'll probably see some photos online.
Oh, that's true. You might be able to match up.
Yeah, you might be able to match up.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it would be not, you shouldn't go out in that, right?
Well, I don't think it would be dangerous if you were to touch it. I mean, you might get a shock, but I'm not sure that it would kill you. But I would not go out because it means that there's a big electric field and you might get hit by a real bolt of lightning.
Yeah.
What I would be worried
I
about.
I would feel the same way.
Yeah. Big storm here in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have, oh, by the way, we have Joseph posted another rainbow photo on Facebook, which is a pretty one from Door County. Thank you for that. If you have one you want to post, please do. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post right there.
And I would compare the two rainbows that we have up there, because the one that had the orange and the yellow sky really doesn't have much of a blue in their rainbow. And this one has a lot more blue, but it doesn't have the red sky.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark in Green Bay wants you to please explain the Willy Waw where air falls down mountainsides. It's my understanding that they're common in Tierra del Fuego, South America, and quite destructive to marine craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. We were talking about this in the break. I read the book by Joshua Slocum, who did a circumnavigation of the world in 1890s, I think, out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. And part of the, of course, you have to go through the Strait of Magellan to do that, and he was there. And he talked about it. That's the only place I'd ever heard the word. This is, a particularly potent valley breeze. And a valley breeze is formed by cooling of the land on the top of the hills as nighttime falls, and then that air gets colder and more dense than the air down in the valley, and it slides down the side of the hills. So if the hills are really dramatic, like they are in the Straits of Magellan and on Tierra del Fuego, then you can have a really rapid acceleration of the air down the hills, and that'll cause a lot of damage. And it's part of the folklore of the Straits of Magellan that they're always stormy. Now, they can't always have a large-scale storm going through them. That's just not going to statistically work out. But they always have strong winds because of these Willy Waws. And there are other places that do this. I think some of the fjord places in Norway have these same kinds of things at certain times of year where it's constantly very strongly windy, and it's just an extreme valley breeze that's funneled by some of the geography.
Interesting. Well, Sean on Facebook has something. I've noticed that whenever it precipitates, the temperature of the air moves closer to the freezing temperature of water, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So when it is below freezing and it precipitates, the air temperature seems to warm. And when it is above freezing, the air temperature seems to cool. Wonders why that's the case.
It's probably not the case actually.
Right, yeah.
It's what does happen when it precipitates. Let's take the case of liquid precipitation first. The air temperature will find what's called the wet bulb temperature, which is somewhere between the actual air temperature and the dew point temperature. So it will go down. And in the summertime is probably the most dramatic examples of that. But in the wintertime, if you have snow falling, you start out on a cold, dry day, and then snow starts to fall, the temperature will also drop to the ice bulb temperature. So it always finds, because there's ice sublimating off of the ice crystals, and that requires energy from the air. So it always cools in the face of precipitation into the air, if the air was unsaturated to begin with.
Yeah.
We have Gail on Facebook. Do you know if steel roofs should be grounded?
If I had a steel roof, I would ground it.
Yeah.
Particularly if I lived in Florida.
Okay, and let's go to Tom in Boulder Junction next. Hi, Tom.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. My question is about solar flares and the effect they have on the Earth's warming, or let's say the last 15 or 17 years that the solar flares have lessened in intensity or frequency, and that Earth is actually cooling off a bit, as opposed to the last 12,000 years that it was warming up since the last ice age. What is the relevance to solar flares and that warming of the Earth? Does that have a big impact on it?
No, the solar flares don't have much of an impact on the global temperature warming. The high-energy particles associated with global flares do things to the electric field of the atmosphere, and that generate things like northern lights and how far south or how much further to the equator that they'll propagate.
So the magnetic field is affected by the solar flares.
Yeah, right. But, yep. But not in terms of the temperature of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. They just don't have that kind of energy.
Okay. so as far as the Earth cooling off the last 15 or 17 years, what is that caused by?
And, I don't believe that's happening. Yeah. I think that this is starting to seemingly come out of the popular press somehow that there's been a, and I know some scientists are talking about a global warming hiatus, as if for the last 20 or so years the temperature hasn't been increasing. But some analysis I've done and recently submitted for publication suggests that that's just not there in the lower troposphere. I'm seeing, and this is a hemispheric picture I'm looking at, I'm not seeing any tendency for there to be a return to cooler temperatures. So it's at least controversial. I don't believe that that's going on from the evidence that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interview I saw yesterday with the founder of the Weather Channel, and I think it was from about a month ago on Channel 9 in Chicago, they interviewed him, and according to the science that he's been conducting, that there's been a cooling off. He didn't mention the solar flares. I've just read that elsewhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Coleman is a noted climate science skeptic. I will say that.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
So that might be part of the equation here. I don't know. I'm not pinning that on him, but I know that that's actually true, and that's part of his background.
There we go. Tom, thank you. I want to give Al in Burlington a chance to join in, too. Al, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I used to live in the UP of Michigan, and I noted, you know, so-called everything else equal, if that's possible, whenever, you know, it'd be like cloudy, you know, like a stratus cloud, not real far up, and then it would clear off, not because of a front, just the clouds move around, and the temperature would just plummet. That's because of the clouds prevent like radiation or something from letting let a lot more heat out when it clears up.
Not if it's nighttime that would happen, but if during the daytime the clouds impact on the solar energy would dominate, and so once the clouds go away.
This is a nighttime thing, pitch black, you know. I watched the temperature change like 15 degrees. That's possible, right?
Yeah. It can be dramatic. Yeah, it's like taking a blanket off.
Here's the other part of that related question. Let's say everything else equal, just again, that almost impossible thing, windy versus still. Is a windy night going to be warmer because of friction than a completely still clear night versus a windy clear night? I've always wondered about that. No one ever seems to. Could you comment?
So what a windy night will do is mix the air, and as opposed to on a calm night, the ground will cool faster, and so it won't mix with the warmer air up above.
Yeah,
sure.
The ground is the entity that loses energy overnight, and that cools the air right near the ground. So if you don't mix it up, you don't get away from the cold.
Yeah,
yeah.
So the wind is because of the mixing prevents the reduced as rapidly temperature.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah.
There you go.
That answer. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Yeah,
thanks, Al, for calling. Eric on Facebook wondered if you could explain what a trough is and how it forms.
Yeah, trough is, there's two types of disturbances that are polar opposites, a trough and a ridge. A trough is a entity in the flow in which the flow comes from the north on the west side and then heads to the north on the east side. And a ridge is just the opposite. The flow comes from the south on the west side and heads to the south on the east side. And the progression of these troughs and ridges, they always come in sequence, really dictates the development of the weather systems that affect us in the middle latitudes, and particularly, obviously so, in the wintertime. To the east of an approaching trough, you'll have a weather system, a mid-latitude cyclone, which will give you clouds, precipitation, bad weather. And to the east of an approaching ridge, the weather will be fair skies, and in the wintertime, cold and clear, in the summertime, sunny, warm, usually less windy. Mm-hmm. And so that the progression of these things across through the atmosphere is what gives us our weather. Where they come from is just their undulations of the what would broadly be a west to east flow across the whole hemisphere if there were no land-ocean differences in temperature, if there were no orography like the Rocky Mountains, the Andes, the Urals, all these other places. So there's a number of different features that can produce the waves in the atmosphere that manifest themselves as troughs and ridges, but that's what impact they have.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy in Grafton has a question. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling.
Well, hello. I wanted to know, what do you guys know about earthquakes? My daughter lives up in Alaska. She's in Sitka, which is southeast on an island. However, I guess the last few days there was another earthquake up there in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I've been reading in the paper about the faults of San Andres fault or whatever it's called here in the United States. I don't know. We haven't had any big experiences with that lately. Do you have any idea of what's going on with earthquakes?
Yeah, no, I don't follow too much about earthquakes. I know there are, in my mind, a lot more than I realized 50 years ago.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah, I don't know much about them either, Nancy, but I sure hope you didn't do the same thing that happens sometimes in a dugout where, you know, you got a no-hitter going for seven innings and then suddenly somebody says, hey, we got a no-hitter going, and then that's the end. I hope that's not it with the San Andreas fault, but yeah. I don't know anything about earthquakes either.
Yeah,
can't help you out there, but thank you for calling. Peter in Stoughton, hello to you.
Good afternoon. About 2 weeks ago, I was traveling in southeast Germany, and we had days that were very much like yesterday was around Madison, lots of cumulus clouds popping up and moving along. It seemed to me, however, that their cumulus clouds were at least a few hundred feet lower than ours are around here, and I was wondering if this was just an illusion or a local landscape effect, or if they were perhaps possibly lower.
It could be any of the above.
Right, yeah, that's right.
The height of that cloud base is going to be a function of the difference between the temperature and the dew point temperature. And as you lift the air up and the air cools down, at some point the temperature and the dew point will be the same, and that's where you'll get the cloud base, and that's why the cloud bases are pretty flat over a large area because it's all occurring at the same altitude. So it'll be depend on how close that what we call the dew point depression is, how far away it is from the temperature.
Yeah. The only thing that wouldn't be a possible explanation is illusion. It's not an illusion. You saw clouds with a lower base, and that can happen even here. It just maybe doesn't happen here as frequently, or that would be an interesting study. But there's a number of things that could go into that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Gene in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Two quick questions. What can we expect, or can you give us an idea of what to expect in August in terms of temperature and rainfall? And my other question is not really related. John, where did you grow up? I'm guessing Massachusetts or the Bronx.
Oh, yes. Well, Gene, I grew up in Massachusetts, where we speak English. And
well, rather odd English.
I grew up in Peabody, Massachusetts, on the North Shore, just north of Boston. I was actually born in Salem, the witch town, but I was brought up in Peabody.
The speech differences fascinate me.
Yeah, me too. No, that's right. And if you know the area, like Steve and I joke about it all the time. You know, we didn't grow up very far apart from each other, but it sounds like a different universe. The gradient of accents is huge in the eastern United States. It's not so big here. If I had to make a guess about August for temperature, I don't know about precipitation. I'd probably say we're going to ride out this summer as a notably mild summer in terms of not terribly hot. We won't have 25 days above 90 degrees in August. We might have one. We only had one in July so far. Maybe we'd have as many as five. But even that would strike us all as an enormous change. So I think we're going to end up with the month of August being, historically anyway, by historic standards, relatively mild.
And on that note, we're all done.
Oh
my goodness, the time flew by.
To go back out into the cool air.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you, guys, both very much for being here. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you.
Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, our guests, and of course, they will be back. And I hope you'll stay with us. We have many good things in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.